welcome back to Bush Out the Door 2004.org Special Information Election 2004 Bulletin Radio Special. Sit back, enjoy the information. Vote your conscience. November 2nd.
Billion here. Me and my boy Felonious Axe gonna take the lyre down to G-Dog's crib in Crawford. And Dickie and Cola gonna bring some freaks too. Gonna have a blast. The billionaires are here with men of the hour. We're sitting pretty chilling in the hall of power. We're buying access, seeing progress, and making a mess of the political process. Oh yes. Our cheese is buying us a whole lot of leverage. When we arrive, they serve us a nice cool beverage. We're the final word on the pending legislation. Please don't play your hate in all the regulating of all corporations and our industries. We're the foxes with the platinum set of henhouse keys. Buying billion-dollar favors for a couple of G's. We got money currency steady blowing in the breeze. We're just living our American dream. The CEOs are playing for the Bush Cheney team. My president, he got you all scared. The billionaires are coming, so you better beware. Step out or stretch hummers and everybody stares. Parents, lock up your daughters, here come the billionaire.
The billionaires are in the house, billionaires.
The billionaires are in the White House. We're dining on pheasant, we're dining on grouse. Yeah, the billionaires are in the house. Dick Cheney worked for us as Halliburton chief exec. Each year we're cutting Dick another $1 million check. These federal contracts just land in our lap. We keep getting away with all the craziest crap. We're ripping off the Pentagon for soldiers' meals. We bribe Nigerian officials making energy deals. We overcharge America, sell Iraq, Kuwaiti oil. But Dick sticks up for us, he's very loyal. If you wanna win a game, you gotta make the rules. We stole an election right in front of you fools. Justice Scalia, I know you got my back. Let's forget about Iraq and shoot birds that go quack. We bought a vice president who totally cares. Kids, get out the way, here come the billionaires.
The billionaires are in the house, billionaires.
The billionaires are in the White House. We'll smack you around like an abusive spouse. Yeah, the billionaires are in the house. We are the kings of Capitol Hill, so just chill. We had a hand in drafting the energy bill. Drug company pockets must be lined, so Medicare reform was made with us in mind. Golden Powell's son gave us the royal jewels when he relaxed on the media ownership rules. We say Bush is our president. You know we ain't kidding. He's taking our money and doing our bidding. Everybody bow to the king. When it's all over, we'll own everything. Our terror alert system got you on your knees while we're picking your pockets and snatching your cheese. We got the USA by its curly short hair, so look out below, here come the billionaires.
The billionaires are in the house, billionaires.
The billionaires are in the White House. We're sucking your blood like a bloated louse. Yeah, the billionaires are in the house. Enron is in the house.
In the White House.
Halliburton is in the house.
In the White House.
Fox News Corp is in the house.
In the White House.
Bechtel is in the house.
In the White House.
Citigroup is in the house.
In the White House.
ExxonMobil is in the house.
In the White House.
Philip Morris is in the house.
In the White House.
Monsanto is in the house.
In the White House.
This administration's preoccupation is directing the nation on wealth consolidation. All those taxes that you pay, they'll be coming our way upon a platinum trace, so don't play. No one can stop us, no one dares. Run for the hills, here comes the billionaire. Run for the hills, here comes the billionaire. Here comes the billionaire.
At last night's school board meeting, the board's chairperson would not elaborate on why Brown. Barakat Salem is a former Egyptian army officer and the government's star witness against Egyptian cleric Dr. Omar Abd Rahman, who the FBI says was the ringleader in the bombing plot. Salem was paid an estimated $1.5 million to infiltrate and inform on Rahman and his followers. He was recruited shortly after the 1991 assassination of right-wing Rabbi Meir Kahane. As an associate of Rahman, Salem traveled in the cleric's inner circle, where he surreptitiously recorded conversations with Rahman. But unknown to his FBI handlers at the time, Salem also recorded his dealings with the government. A newspaper article revealed the existence of the tapes, and the Reuters news agency received written transcripts. A copy of one of the most revealing conversations between Ahmad Salem and an FBI agent named John was recently acquired by WBAI. In that conversation, Salem demands more money from the FBI, outlining his contributions to the agency, including a cryptic statement by Salem to the FBI. Salem says, "We know the bombs start to be built by your confidential informant." According to a source close to the case, Ahmad Salem checked into a Manhattan hospital 3 hours after the blast, complaining of a severe ringing in his ears. A hospital spokesperson refuses to confirm or deny the report. Salem also mentions a defendant convicted in the World Trade Center bombing, Mohammed Aboulima, a man Salem says he located in Egypt for the FBI. The first voice is Ahmad Salem, the second FBI agent John.
The Abu Halima will be killed and hidden and gone forever, and you will never know about him that he ever went to Egypt. Mm-hmm. Will be off the record. And then you have the greatest suspect is gone and lost forever. And you will keep looking for him for the rest of your life. See how much that will cost you. But because you get aware that he's there and you requested him, Egypt stopped it immediately.
Now, even the last 3 weeks is going to be a nice payment. I'm just telling you for the future and what the expenses, they just don't want to buy in on $500 a week expenses. That's all. We're just going to have to give me the... you know, some of the expenses, and they'll pay what operationally they are allowed to pay.
Let me think about it.
Don't think it. There's nothing to think about.
Of course I have to think about it. I mean, I have...
And then later on, there's bonuses and things of that nature. The only thing I'm telling you different than from before is that it's not a salary.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I'm telling you that is different than what we were doing anyway.
Yeah.
Okay?
Listen to go recruit Ahmad Abdu. Or let him to go talk to Ahmad Abdel Sattar. Ahmad Sattar, he's a good subject. He can really give you a big help.
Yeah.
Let him really to give you a big help.
He doesn't understand everything.
Well, he have to understand. He is the boss. We all running our heads around this boss. So he got to understand this point.
But basically nothing has changed. I'm just telling you for my own sake.
Yeah.
That this isn't a salary, that it's, you know, but you got paid regularly for good information. I mean, the expenses were a little bit out of the ordinary, and it was really questioned. Don't tell Nancy I told you this.
I have to tell her, of course.
Well, then if you have to, you have to.
Yeah, because, I mean, the lady was being honest, and I was being honest, and everything was submitted with a receipt.
Yeah.
And now it's questionable.
It's not questionable. It's like a little out of ordinary.
Okay.
You know...
All right. I don't think it was. If that's what you think, guys, fine. But I don't think that because we was start already building the bomb, which is went off in the World Trade Center. It was built by supervision from the Bureau and the GA. And we was all informed about it, and we know that the bomb start to be built. By who? By your confidential informant. What a wonderful, great case.
Well,
and then he put his head in the sand and said, "Oh, no, that's not true. He is son of a bitch." Okay.
Well,
it's built with a different way in another place, and that's it.
Well, don't make any risk. You know, I'm just trying to be as honest with you as I can.
Of course, I appreciate that.
And as far as the the payments go and everything like that, they're there. I guarantee you that they are there. I'm just saying they are there. They have to be documented.
Mm-hmm.
They don't pay a salary. All right, just think about it that way.
Sorry.
I have to document every time I put in what we call a blue slip to request funds for your services. Attached to the blue slip has to be documentation as to what you've done. Period. That's it.
Yeah.
And the circles that you're running around in, that stuff is never going to go dry. However, I would like to see you just continue going on making a living as you are. Because in the future, you're going to have to, or maybe want to slow down. I mean, sitar does it. I don't know, you know, the whole Catholic Council with NASA, all those people, they all work, engineers working here, working there. It would be better for you.
Yeah.
Okay, I know you're doing a great job building your credibility, but in a month or so, you're going to tell them, hey, guys, you know, I got bills to pay. I'm going to be available in the evenings or the weekends. Now you still get the same kind of money, but you're still making your other money working there.
Mm.
Yeah, does that make sense? Am I making sense at all?
No.
No.
No, I'm being honest, too. I'm being honest, too.
I know you want to be very aggressive. You want to go in there, you know, full force.
I am going full force. I am working from the bottom of my heart. Nobody requested me to work till midnight. I leave at 9 o'clock in the morning. I come back midnight, go to sleep, and get up next morning to... And get exposed to people who's trying to, like, an hour today with this reporter trying to just grab something out of my teeth. And I got a thing that will be on the bureau. It got to be with a certain level. It shouldn't be very high. It shouldn't be. And I got to cover up my back with the people. They got to be happy about what I'm saying. You know, like, I have two reporters coming in their way now.
Mm.
I got to speak to them, untie the bureau, and be extremely damn careful, so one day when I get questions about that, I should be, you know, leveled. So it's a hard game to make Ahmed Absattar happy, and to make Dr. Rahman happy, and to make the reporters happy.
I feel just like you do right now, trying to make everybody happy.
I know,
happy.
And to make Mr. John happy. What's his last name?
Who?
John what?
Krauthammel.
Grand?
Krauthammel, German last name. Krauthammel.
Krauthammel.
Yeah.
Okay, whatever.
But, look, besides all this bureaucratic bullshit,
yeah.
We're going to still do a good job.
Yeah.
Okay? And, you know, don't worry. You've gone too far.
That's what happened the first time. The first time I went so far, so quickly, I took the man to Detroit, I started taking care of things. And we were surprised, and you get wonder how come this guy going that far that quickly. And that makes him, you know, like, oh, no, that's not good. Okay. This guy is a professional guy. This guy is doing things he learned to do it. So let him to work.
Yeah.
Let him to work. And like I'm telling you, John, one thing you can always say, if Ahmed Salem falsified any information to the bureau, be honest with me, say yes or no.
Sorry, say
that
again?
Did I ever verified information and you find me falsified any information to the bureau?
Falsified?
Right?
No.
All right. So every single information I supplied it, it's very excellent and correct. I was talking to Sayyid Nusayr's wife yesterday.
Yeah.
And she's going to visit him today. And I will be going to visit him next week.
Okay.
As per the arrangement. What am I supposed to do this trip? I don't have money to do this trip from the very beginning. And then to go over there and the guy will ask me to build a bomb again or to kidnap a judge again or to get in touch of so-and-so to help me do so-and-so. Who will do that? Who else will do that?
Nobody. Nobody could do that.
Okay. You know, we're wasting time. We're wasting
example,
time.
Let me tell you something.
Yes.
We're talking about, like, this money over here. Well, when you come up with big things, like, you know, we got, like, a few of them already. You know, the fact that we got a head start on Abu Huldin's brother and the fact that, I don't even know.
One second. One of the reporters arrived, I guess.
All right. Look.
One second.
All right.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes?
No, it's me.
Okay. I'll be right down. Thank you. Okay, bye.
Is that one of them?
No, that's delivery.
Oh. But, the only thing that's changed is I told you how the payment system works.
Okay.
That's all.
Mm-hmm.
And just keep going, and like I'm saying, when you have good information, that's a real bonus that leads to other information.
Who will evaluate this is a good information, real bonus or not? Who will evaluate that?
Who evaluates that?
Yeah. Who will say that this is a valuable information and who will say, okay, we have this phone number already, so what's the big deal? We know that he has a fax, so nothing big deal. So what? The man has a fax. But when you know that this guy has a communication all over the world over these facts and the Bureau doesn't know about it, I think it's a very valuable information.
Yeah. Well, we'll see.
Okay.
But like I said, there's a lot of good information in a short 3 weeks that has come. You've come right back to where you were 6 months ago, 7 months ago.
I guess more.
More and more.
Now he's coming again to mess it up. And once I'm stubborn too, because I get tired of that. If I withdraw myself again, forget it, to gain or to earn this kind of trust from these people anymore.
Don't withdraw.
I was planning to grab my car and jump to Brooklyn tonight. I'm not going. Because, of course, I didn't go to the court today. Muhammad Ibn al-Gabruni and Ali al-Gabruni and Muhammad Abu Halima, three of them was waiting for me over there.
But do these people work at all?
No, they are not.
But you have to explain them, too, that you can't go to every single thing. I mean,
If I didn't go to every single thing, I'm not going to bring information. Plain and simple. Am I right or wrong?
Yeah, you're right, but,
So even they don't want me around, I gotta try to find an excuse to put myself there. In this meeting, when they having dinner, I gotta go squish my nose between them trying to make myself, like, hungry. And I'm not. To listen what's going on. That's why when I heard Muhammad Abu Halima say that he went with his brother and Muhammad Salama, and there is some kind of whispering in their ears from Sayyid Nasir. How valuable this information to you?
It's good.
It is good and it's very important. And will let us to go back on the paperwork and see these people went together and then give that to the district attorney who can say these people went so and so and so. And we have reports that they was talking to this guy, three of them. What is the link between three of them? And you know, things. It's a lot of things too.
Everything's the same. I'm just telling you, the only thing I told you was regarding the payments. I mean, what difference does it make what I told you half an hour ago or what you were expecting 2 hours ago? That's all.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just telling you what has been relayed to me.
Okay, John, I really feel sorry for you. I mean, I swear to God, because I really like you very much and I have a great respect for you. I feel so sorry for you for what you tried to do.
I feel sorry for me too.
I know. I mean, really.
I
know that. Therefore, go back to work and, you know, don't be mad at me.
I'm not mad. Believe me, I'm very frustrated
I will just try to cool myself down until this guy is coming within in any minutes now.
Yeah.
I got to be ready to speak to him.
Yeah, but just, look, there's going to be a payment coming. Like, for example, here's the first paragraph, right?
Yes.
So-and-so went to New York District Court with Mohammed Al-Gabruni and then returned to Abu Bakr Mosque in Brooklyn where he met with Ahmed Sattar and Mohammed Hassan. Telephone number so-and-so. Hassan is identical to Mohammed Hassan Abdul,
right,
which is well known to the New York office and the close associates of Saeed Nasser and Rockman at the Mosque. Sattar, Al-Gabruni, Mohammed Hassan, and so-and-so went to the basement. They talk, you know, I'm going to talk about what they talked about and it's about Abu Halima, and it just goes on and on and on and on and on. And I'm going to ask, you know, for good money. One of these things in a month payment should justify that kind, you know, the kind of money you're talking about.
Yeah.
I'm just telling you that's the way it's happening. Same thing to tell you. It's the same. It's the same.
By the size, it's a former Spanish colony.
Is it the only former Spanish colony in sub-Saharan Africa?
It is the only former Spanish colony in sub-Saharan Africa, and it's altogether it's around 500,000 to 600,000 people.
That's very small. Were you surprised by the news of an attempted coup?
No, because as a Cameroonian, we have access to a lot of news from Central African Republic. And from time to time, we have another story on a failed coup d'etat in Equatorial Guinea. So many people on this side of Africa are now believing that every time there's a new information on an attempt of a coup d'etat in Equatorial Guinea, people tend to say, oh, another one, just another one. And this is exactly what I took at the beginning, that, one more story like that, and nothing else will happen in the news. So I was surprised when finally it became such a big story.
Well, Abraham, hasn't this story been developing for a while now? Weren't those mercenaries that were arrested in Zimbabwe 6 months ago connected to this coup attempt?
Yes, definitely. A man named Simon Mann, who is a soldier of fortune, was picked up and arrested and then sent out a letter, not very good code, sort of implicating various people in the British establishment and also mentioning, I think, Scratcher, which people did figure out was a nickname for Mark Thatcher.
Not subtle.
Very good code. But these kinds of attempts have, as the other, your other interviewer have mentioned, have been going on for a long time. There's a book called The Dogs of War, which was written in the early 1970s by John Forsythe, which is actually a novel that came out of an abortive attempt, very much like this one, where you had European mercenaries attempting to overthrow the first dictator. And that failed, and then became a novel. It was turned into a novel. Forsythe also wrote The Day of the Jackal.
Now, so obviously Equatorial Guinea has been seen as a ripe plum by people because oil was discovered there, or was that earlier book about an Equatorial Africa, Equatorial Guinea before oil was discovered?
Well, oil is really now very much part of the story. Equatorial Guinea may supply as much as 25% of America's oil in the next decade. And for a country the size of Maryland, that's a lot. But even in the early 1970s, it was strategic. In the Biafran War, aid was flown into Biafra via Bioko, which is the insular part of Equatorial Guinea. And the area was viewed as very strategic. It's right where Cameroon, Nigeria, Gabon come together. And so you had a lot of competing interest. When I was there many years ago as a student, there was a Soviet embassy and a Cuban embassy and, of course, a U.S. embassy, all sort of competing in an area that was viewed as a kind of listening post in Central Africa.
Samuel, the plotters arrested in Zimbabwe were mostly Afrikaners. Mark Thatcher is British. What are they doing in a country that was a former Spanish colony?
I don't think it's possible to say that being a former colony will prevent other countries or people from other countries to have or to try to have interest in Equatorial Guinea. Because now you'll be probably surprised, but Equatorial Guinea is now part of the Franc Zone, which is the economic area of the former French colonies, sharing the same currency, the CFA franc. And the French is now one of the official tongues there. The oil interests there are much more controlled by the American companies. So it's a type of summary of globalization, I will say. It's a crossroads for many different type of interest and many different type of activities, legal or illegal. And one of the reasons why, why I suspect some South Africans were involved in this attempt is the fact that they have a very good experience. It's in South Africa that you can find people with a very good experience, mercenaries. And their experience is very well recognized everywhere else in Africa. So I suspect somebody willing to start a coup d'etat in an African country will first look in such a country. In addition to that, other places where, from where it's possible to start destabilizing activities in Equatorial Guinea are neighboring countries, and I don't think none of them will be at this time ready to get involved into these type of activities. First, because as a new El Dorado, they have a lot of nationals going in Equatorial Guinea seeking jobs, and if they get involved in such an attempt and it fails, it means lot of problems in the relationship with Equatorial Guinea, and this will have consequences for all their nationals living there.
Abraham,
this is why I was not also very much surprised hearing that South Africans were involved. I was much more surprised to hear about the name of Mark Thatcher.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Abraham, the coup plotters hope to gain with if they overthrew this president? Now, this is a president who is as corrupt as any dictator in the world, isn't he?
Yes. He, and I've been reading reports where, you know, he's compared to his uncle, whom he had executed in 1979. He is an improvement over his uncle, but has a horrible human rights record. And I think that what the mercenaries were hoping to do, the mercenaries have been accused by the Equatorial Guinean government for of working for the opposition. So they're actually, they have a plot scenario. And that is that the opposition leader, Severo Moto, had landed in Mali, that the mercenaries would take over the airports, block off, set up roadblocks, and take over the radio station. And then Mr. Moto, who was in Mali, would land, and there would be a general uprising.
And now, would he... would his record in the past indicate that he would be a better leader than President Obiang is?
It's hard to say. He has been imprisoned various times and tortured various times. So he's never, unfortunately, he's never been allowed to participate actively in politics. And there is a government in exile which is based in Spain, where he lives. I think that, and this is, I'm going out on a limb, but I think that this would be an improvement. I don't know, like I say, the opposition doesn't have a track record because it's never been allowed to participate actively. But the present president was in charge of security under the old dictatorship. So he actually applied the muscle under the first dictatorship from 68 to 79 and was in charge of eliminating enemies of the regime, and in that period, 68 to 79, one-third of the population was either killed or went into exile, fled into Cameroon or Gabon. The French philosopher Ramon Aron called it a cottage industry Auschwitz. I mean, it was a horrible situation. And the present president was actually in charge of security and in charge of eliminating enemies of the regime. So I think a change probably would be a change for the better.
Samuel, I understand that a court in Equatorial Guinea recently suspended the trial of 18 accused plotters at the request of the prosecution. Do you know about that?
No, I was following the trial like everybody else, and what I realized was that, first, despite the fact that the death penalty is still in vigor in Equatorial Guinea, there was a clear commitment from the president saying that there will be no death penalty for none of the people involved. And I think, given the very bad human rights records of the president, I think he's somehow obliged to, together with continuing with the prosecution of the people involved in the coup, he's obliged to make sure that he will send a very strong signal, or at least not to be exposed by the international community, by making sure that first, the trial will be as fair as possible, and second, nobody will lose his life at the end of the prosecution.
My guests on this special segment of our underreported series are Samuel Nguifo, director of the Center for Environment and Development in Cameroon, and he's talking to us from Cameroon, the capital city?
Yes.
And that is?
Yaoundé.
And also speaking to us from Brandeis, where he's a professor of history, is Ibrahim Sundiata. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Find out about the special situation with the oil companies in Equatorial Guinea and how it compares to the situation in Cameroon and in Nigeria, some of the other countries in Africa that have recently become oil rich. Stay with us here on WNYC. Later in the show, we'll speak with filmmaker Tobias Peirce about his new documentary that deals with the difficulties Muslim and Arab Americans have faced after September 11th, and he'll be joined by someone who was detained for over a year and then deported from this country. We'll also continue our look at third world experiences with some immigrants who are turning painful experiences into humor. Indian American comedians Vijay Nathan and Vidur Kapoor talk about growing up in a world of culturally mixed messages. And finally, writer and journalist and MTV 2 star Touré will discuss his new novel, Soul City. All coming up here on WNYC. Talk and news all day, classical music all night. Stay with us.
Good people are boring and happy families are all alike.
Studio 360.
So Tolstoy said.
Yeah, and Tolstoy's wrong.
The next big thing.
The DJ's console looked like a spaceship command center in a sci-fi movie from the 1950s. The extra thick platters on the turntables spun way fast. 78 times per minute, in fact.
Weekends on WNYC.
WNYC is supported by MrBite.com, a food portal providing access to a wide selection of restaurants that offer online reservations, takeout, and delivery services, with searches by food category and neighborhood, online at MrBite.com.
WNYC gratefully acknowledges the backing of our corporate underwriters and would like to add your business to our diverse list of supporters. To become a WNYC underwriter, contact Executive Director Vincent Gardino at 212-669-3013.
I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. We're talking about attempted coups in a country we don't hear much about, Equatorial Guinea. And I'm talking about it with Samuel Nguifo, who lives right next door in Cameroon. He's director of the Center for Environment and Development in Cameroon. And also, Ibrahim Sundiata, professor of history at Brandeis. So when was oil discovered in Equatorial Guinea?
Okay, oil was discovered in the 1960s, or the presence of oil was known. And it took, 30 years for actually oil to go in production.
And why is that? Because oil went into production in Nigeria and in the Cameroon much earlier.
Right. Equatorial Guinea's regime was so capricious that for the years 68 to 79, that although oil companies were talking to the government, it was impossible to reach contracts. There were even talks about assaults on people who were prospecting. So when the first president left office, or was executed, prospecting resumed, and so it, unlike Cameroon and Nigeria, real production was delayed until the 1990s, and now it's booming. I mean, it's thought that Equatorial Guinea will produce 500,000 barrels per day.
How much is that compared to some of the other countries we know? Obviously less than Saudi Arabia, but what about other countries in the Middle East?
It will probably be, there's more U.S. investment. I think that Equatorial Guinea has the third highest rate of U.S. investment. and it may provide 25% of U.S. oil imports in the next decade, which is, for a country the size of Maryland, a lot.
Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming, Samuel, that that everyone is gaining something from this, that because so few people and so much money, that all the citizens of Equatorial Guinea have become rich.
I will not be as optimistic as you are. And I think what we are witnessing now in Equatorial Guinea is exactly what we saw in other oil producers' countries in Africa, in Central Africa. The country was very poor, and suddenly, when oil exploitation started, there's a lot of money, but this money is not going down to the poor, to the poor. The country is, the regime has a lot of plans for the country. And when you look at the plans, it's again very, very similar to what we had in Cameroon, in Congo, in Equatorial Guinea, in Gabon. It's a lot of public investments, building roads, building very huge equipments in the country, which will have really nothing to do with fighting poverty. And finally, those benefiting from the oil money will probably be oil companies, the people in power, and a lot of foreign companies will be contracted to get involved into all these big investments, the construction of all these big investments. I think it's important to keep in mind that on the grounds of the current proven reserves, oil reserves in Equatorial Guinea, it's altogether 1.1 billion barrels of oil. And if the production of 2003 is maintained, it only means 8 years of production for Equatorial Guinea if no new oil reserve is discovered. And I think there's so much oil in the area that it's likely that new oil reserves will be discovered. But in absolute term, this is not a lot of oil, 1.1 billion barrels. If you compare it to Nigeria, for example, with reserve of 34 billion barrels, or with Libya with 36 billion barrels, it's completely different. But if you look at the size of the country, the size of the population, it's a lot, and it can really make a difference for all the country there. But looking at the trends that we have, Equatorial Guinea seems not to be on good tracks. They seem to have followed the path of the former oil producers' country in Africa. And this is very sad, because the experience we have from oil producers' countries in Africa is that oil revenue have never been translated into money for development.
And what's happened in your country, Cameroon, where the oil reserves have been largely exploited? Has that meant any kind of improvement in the lot of its citizenry?
You can't say it. Of course, some part of the oil money was used to start some big investment, to build some roads, to start very big buildings. But this money, as I said, stays in cities and goes with big foreign companies, which are contracted to build these equipments. But you can't see how this money is really translated into meeting the development need of the poorest of the poor. Mm-hmm.
For a while, Nigeria was held up as a success story, but serious problems have developed there as well. Is it always because of oil? Is oil the sole cause, or did its discovery exacerbate existing tensions in all of the countries we're talking about?
I think in the case of Equatorial Guinea, oil exacerbates already existing tensions. If you look at the map, you see the country is there's an island, Bioko. And then there's a mainland portion of around 10,000 square miles, Rio Muni. And most of the oil is around the island. But most of the population is on the mainland, south of Cameroon and north of Gabon. And so you get the majority of the population being in an area that doesn't have the oil. And even before independence, there was a maldistribution of wealth between the island portion and the mainland portion. Equatorial Guinea actually had a high literacy rate and a fairly high GNP in 1968 based on exportation of cocoa and lumber. And a very high literacy rate. And what happened is the economy sort of came apart, and underneath there were these tensions between the two portions, between the cocoa-producing area and the timber-producing area, which was poorer. Now we still have that tension because we have the former cocoa-producing area now producing the oil. And it is very sad that there. One of the things that happens is there's very little transparency in the making of contracts between the government and Western companies like ExxonMobil, for instance. There's the budgets are not very clear as to where the money is going. And so although some people have talked about Equatorial Guinea as the Kuwait of Africa, I mean, you have this population of less than half a million, the size of Maryland, this could really be a tremendous success story because of the low population. It hasn't happened. And the question is, will the money be frittered away before the reserves die off or go away?
Everything was submitted with a receipt.
Yeah.
And now it's questionable.
It's not questionable. It's like a little out of ordinary.
Okay.
You know.
All right. I don't think it was. If that's what you think, guys, fine. But I don't think that because we was start already building the bomb, which is went off in the World Trade Center. It was built by supervision from the Bureau and the DA, and we was all informed about it, and we know that the bomb started to be built. By who? By your confidential informant. What a wonderful, great case.
Wow.
And then he put his head in the sand and said, oh, no, that's not true. He is son of a bitch. Okay. Oh. It's built with a different way in another place, and that's it.
If it doesn't...
Push Out the Door 2004.org special broadcast.